set.
You're listening to
The Antioch Podcast.
Conversations about biblical anti-racism.
Have mercy.
Let me say it one more time. The Antioch Podcast.
The Antioch Podcast is a ministry of Preach System.
Oh, I got Jesus, yay.
Hello, welcome to the Antioch Podcast, Conversations about Biblical Anti-Racism. My name is Eric Nykamp. Today, we're joined by John Williams, Director of the Fellowship Center for Racial Reconciliation in Monrovia, California. John was a former member of John Perkins' Harambe Center and is a nationally sought-after anti-racism educator who combines history and theology in his justice education initiatives. He joins us today for the first of a two-part series on how racism affects individuals and communities. This episode focuses on people of color and the impact of internalized racial oppression. Let's go now and listen to this conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Antioch Podcast, where we have conversations about biblical anti-racism. This is another exciting day for us because we have a special guest. Who it is, you're going to have to wait just a minute to see. But we're going to introduce ourselves in the usual way so you'll know who's in the room and around the mic. We will give our name as well as our racial ethnic identity. And then our question for today is, what's your least favorite chore and what are some of the ways you've avoided doing it? I will get us started. My name is Michelle and I identify as an African-American woman and my least favorite chore is dusting. What are some of the ways that I have avoided doing it? I went to work.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't do it. Dust bunnies don't bother me and I don't bother them. I just think that's all a part of being vegan. There we go.
Dust bunnies are having a party.
They're fine. They're fine. But if you give me, you know, at least an hour's notice that you're coming, I will remove some of them. But otherwise, yeah, they're good.
The rest are staying.
That's just kindness to all bunnies. Okay. Susie, how about you?
Yeah. So I'm Susie Dixon. I'm Puerto Rican and Italian. And my least favorite chore, this is not going to be a surprise to our listeners, it's cooking. I think cooking is a chore, especially when you're a mom. And so it's been nice having being an empty nester because my husband loves to cook and he's just isn't so, he's an awesome cook. And I avoid cooking when I have people around or when I know people are going to be around by saying, well, what would you guys like to bring? That's how I avoid it. What would you like to bring? Great. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And then I asked Terry if he's going to be home. Cause if he's going to be home, then he'll help cook. That's it.
That's cool. Reggie, how about you?
I'm Reggie Smith and I identify as an African-American male. And my least favorite chore is anything that has to do with the outside. So lawn, cutting lawn, and how I avoid it, I just let it grow.
I can see you saying, let it grow.
I don't care. I could be growing sequoias, redwoods, maple trees. I don't care.
It's great for the environment.
Yes.
Hey, I'm trying to bring it back to the original creation. That's all I'm trying to do. You say I'm just an originalist.
I love it.
Let it be.
Oh, that's funny.
I grew up in a place where you let it be, and people would come and just mow it for you. That works too.
Come on and mow.
New Washington, shout out to you.
Oh wow! Hands are not hurt. Come on, you can mow it.
Knock out my
satisfaction. Jane, how about you?
My name is Jane Bruin. I identify as a Pakistani Punjabi American woman. And I actually, like most chores, I really hate laundry. And the way that I avoid doing laundry is I got me asthma and autoimmune disease that makes it hard for me to go downstairs, and a house that has laundry in the basement. So my dear husband helps me out that way.
Oh my goodness. That is funny.
That's kind of extreme, though.
Okay. Yeah. maybe I didn't do it to avoid laundry. Avoid laundry because of those.
That is so funny. Okay, that is my favorite chore.
Oh, wow. See, yep. Y'all two should get together. Y'all should have houses next door. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
It's a village. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Eric, how about you?
Hi, my name is Eric Nykamp. I identify as a white man, and I'm kind of in Reggie's camp. Anything outdoors, but specifically pulling weeds. Pulling weeds is the worst. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that probably brings up some childhood trauma. Not gonna lie. I think as a child, I was made to pull weeds. That was like how you'd earn like little bits of allowance money. Uh-uh. And I passed on that learning opportunity to all of my children. And that was one of the ways that, you know, I paid that forward. And so that's one of the ways that I kind of avoided that as an adult. And now I am getting right on the edge of where that is not going to work anymore. You know, I'm thinking there's these new kind of ways of doing your lawn where you kind of, they have like these like no grass lawns and, you know, and I've been looking at that and I'm thinking, yeah,
I like that.
There is something to that. My next door neighbor has one of those. And I'm like, that's something. And it's really good for the environment.
Yeah. No grass lawn. I'm going to have to look that up. I've never heard of that.
Vegetable garden lawns,
or just rocks, or something like that, or mulch. See,
that's
or something like that, a mulch design, rock garden, something like that. Yeah. So my husband passed on the chore of removing the snow, right? Snow blowing, snow shoveling, and usually snow shoveling, not with a snow blower, to the boys. All our kids have moved to warm places, anywhere where it snows.
Yeah.
And they all watch the weather reports. We all watch the weather report for what it's like for wherever we are.
Uh-huh.
And it never fails. On the heavy snow days, the youngest ones sends us a meme. Just kind of rubbing it in a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's like, and this is why I'm in Virginia.
Yeah.
But don't you want to come here? No.
Nope.
So be careful about passing chores onto your kids because it might drive them far from your house, even though you might love each other.
Funny.
I'm still working on that because I'm still trying to get my twins out of my house.
Well, you know. You got to find what they love. All right.
That's funny.
Well, you know, this is good. This is the regular crew. But as I had said, we have a special guest with us today. And so our guest today is none other than Mr. John Williams. And so, John, I wonder if you would introduce yourself and answer our question about your least favorite chore and how you avoid it. And then just tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. Absolutely. It's funny. I'm sitting here listening to these least favorite chores. And I'm kind of thinking I might just be lazy.
probably not.
I had one and then someone else said something else and then someone else said something else. And I'm like, wait, what do I like to do? But I'll answer the question. My least favorite chore is actually folding and putting away clothes. Like I don't mind washing and drying it. It's actually sitting down folding. And if I'm going to be really honest, it's the putting away part, which drives my wife and my kids bananas when it's my turn to do laundry. So that's probably my least favorite.
It just stacks up.
When your kids are adults like mine, when they won't put them away, they'll just look at them and roll their eyes.
Yes,
like,
they will. That's yes, they you. Will. Yes, they will.
But anyway, I'm John Williams. I am the director of the Fellowship Center for Racial Reconciliation, which is in Monrovia, California. And I have been the director since the summer of 2016. And basically what we do is we help to create space and curate space for conversations around the issues of race, racism, and reconciliation. And one of the other things that we do, and probably my most favorite part of my job, is to lead in immersive learning experiences by doing Southern civil rights tours, Asian American civil rights tours, local history tours. So I think in my heart of hearts, I'm a historian and just really love trying to understand the intersection of race, history, and faith. And so, so right now I feel like I'm just in the perfect job for me.
John, this sounds really fascinating, the work that you are doing and how all these different pieces are coming together. I'm pretty sure we're going to hear a bit more about that as you just fill us in a little bit more about your passion, which is IRO, otherwise known as internalized racial oppression.
Yeah, it's funny. That of all the things that I do, even when I'm doing the immersive trips or we're in our trainings, is I try to help folks focus on the manifestation of racism. What's the impact both on the individual as well as on systems? And how does racism impact us in a way, in the way that we relate to one another, the way that people of color relate to white folks, the way that some people of color relate to other people of color. And it was about 7 years ago that that I was even introduced to this concept of internalized racial oppression or internalized racial inferiority. And it was actually at my very first core anti-racism workshop. And I remember sitting in that training, and I came because I have a very good friend who used to be one of your facilitators, Coffee Carrasco. And I just remember sitting in there, and when they gave the definition and when they unpacked it and explained what it actually is when, for me, it's like, oh, it just really gave me language. And it's from that moment forward, it's really helped me to frame and to shape and to understand how I parent, how I interact with my wife, how I interact with people of color and white folks. It just really has given me a great framing for understanding the impact of racism and how we can overcome racism, how we can be better at being anti-racist, and how we can fight white supremacist culture. And so so that's how, you know, how I got into really looking at this. And so probably is good if I give a definition. Like, some folks might be saying, what the heck are they talking about? And so the definition that CORE uses, the definition that I use, is internalized racial inferiority or oppression is a complex, multi-generational socialization process that teaches people of color to believe, to accept, and to live out negative societal definitions of self and fit into and live out inferior societal roles. And these behaviors help to support and maintain the current racial construct that's in our country. And so I also think about Dr. Shaniqua Walker-Barnes and how she defines it and explains it in one of her works. And she says, racism robs all of us of the ability to think for ourselves. Mm-hmm. When people of color internalize the view that whiteness is superior to all other races, including their own, we call this internalized oppression. In a society where the superiority of whiteness is transmitted via multiple systems, for example, mass media, educational institutions, corporations, and culture, internalized oppression is not an unusual occurrence or merely the exception to the rule. It is the rule. It is a universal phenomenon. It is not limited to childhood, but extends throughout the lifespan. It is so ubiquitous that detecting and reconfiguring the ways in which we have internalized racism takes considerable intentional effort. And so those help for me, those are like two ways of framing it and helping me to understand it and to help me to teach it and to teach others on how to teach it as well.
How hard is it for people that you work with or who come to you to accept that IRO is a thing?
It's funny. I think for people of color, it's not very difficult. For white folks, it is very difficult for them to accept. Actually, it's not difficult for white folks to understand internalized racial oppression or inferiority. It's much more difficult for them to understand and accept internalized racial superiority, which I know we'll talk about in another episode. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of people of color, once we kind of give that definition and start to unpack it with giving really clear examples of the different manifestations of it, it's almost like, and I see this almost every training that I've done, is it's almost like a light bulb goes off in people's minds. It's like, oh, that's what it is. And again, for me, when you really dig into it, you see, I mean, I've looked at it in so many different ways. For example, the way that I parent and how I raise my kids with some of the manifestations and how, unfortunately, I passed on some of those manifestations onto them. And it wasn't until we learned to interrogate and to do what Dr. Walker Barnes talks about, is take that considerable intentional effort to really look at our racial formation, look at how, you know, we grew up racially and how that growing up racially has impacted each person.
So you said that for people of color, it doesn't take much for them to see it.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to those, or what do you say to those who refuse to see it?
Great question. Yeah, so it's not all people of color. So that's a very good distinction. I appreciate that. There definitely are people of color who are like, no, I don't see it. It's I think people who kind of reject it are really more into thinking of hyper individuality, where it's like, mm-hmm. No, it's all about how we are able to overcome racism, or racism is not as impactful as you purport it is. And so I don't really believe that that's a thing. And what's fascinating, I think those who do that, one of the biggest manifestations that they exhibit is distancing. Oftentimes people who don't want to believe that this is a thing will consistently distance themselves from other people of color. And they'll say, well, if other people of color would work harder, if they would try harder, then they can be successful in this country. And they completely ignore the systems that may be negatively impacting or hindering one's success in this country.
Yeah. Or benefiting from that success.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right. Or benefiting. And that is a big thing. Dr. Wilkerson, who wrote CAST, she talks about it in this way, because there's this benefit or there is this punishment that happens when we don't act out the racial kind of caste that has been created in our country. And she says, like, day after day, the curtain rises on the stage of epic proportions. And this is a quote from her book, CAST, one that has been running for centuries. The actors wear the costumes and of their predecessors and inhabit the roles assigned to them. The people in these roles are not the characters they play, but they have played the roles long enough to incorporate the roles into their very being, to merge the assignment with their inner selves and how they are seen in the world. And she goes on to say that if you start to act outside of the roles that have been designated for you, if you start to break out of these manifestations of IRO, that you can get punished, you can get harm, you kind of topple the way that things are supposed to be, you will get labeled as being a troublemaker, or not wanting to kind of do what you need to do to get forward and to move and to progress and to be promoted. So it's really an interesting kind of play that just kind of operates on day to day.
How do you have those conversations?
So the easiest way that I have them is it's one of the sessions that we lead in our anti-racism trainings that we call our racial reconciliation workshops. And so there's a whole section where myself or someone else of color will give the definition, unpack the definition through personal stories that they have experienced. And I think that the best way to talk about this is through personal stories, that if I can demonstrate and give examples of the different manifestations, it's easier for people to relate how it impacts them. And in kind of a way, it normalizes it. And it's like, okay, it's not something bad. It's just something that happens that we need to work on. And for us, we anchor it around some key passages of scripture. In the Gospels, Jesus talks about we have to die daily. And that dying daily, we typically think of that in kind of our traditional ways of how we understand scripture. That might mean, you know, I'm not supposed to lie, I'm not supposed to be greedy, I'm not supposed to be those things. But we don't really dig in and think about that dying daily is dying to the internalized racism that has been put upon us and that we've lived out. I also think that the passage in Romans where Paul is talking about be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed. And we think again that conformity is, well, don't be hyper greedy, don't be, you know, the standard things that we hear in church about what are the things that we shouldn't conform to, but we never talk about how we all conform to the way that race has played out in this country and how it's discussed and how it, how it operates. We don't talk about not being conformed that way. We don't talk about the necessity of being transformed in a way that really allows us to express the real Imago Dei that's within us, to really be our truest and our most authentic selves.
Can you give examples? I've heard you talk about these before, about how IRO shows up for people in different racial ethnic groups and how that might be different from groups to group, because I think it shows up differently. And you when you do your training, do a really good job of expressing those differences, because I think there are some unique differences that you do a good job expressing in your trainings.
Sure. So one manifestation is what's called exaggerated visibility. And what exaggerated visibility is it's a reaction to the feeling of being invisible that racism creates for people of color. So the way that it may manifest, and so it's not just race that it manifests differently. It's going to be race, it's going to be gender, and it's going to be class. And so the way that exaggerated visibility may be demonstrated within, say, a Black lower class community is what we stereotypically see with rappers or with sports athletes, where there's this the gold chains, the big cars, the big houses, And really what studies have shown is that when that's happening, the person or that group are really just saying, see me, you really need to see me because I've been so ignored by the larger society. And if I can be quote unquote loud, if I can be loud in my clothes and all those things, then that's the exaggerated visibility. You're exaggerating yourself, either what you have or what you wear, so that people can see you. Now, that will manifest very differently if you're an upper class, wealthy African-American person. It may manifest in that way when you go into rooms of where you're in predominantly white spaces. You're going to make sure that you are dressed impeccably the way that that society says a business person should dress. You're going to still wear like expensive jewelry like Rolexes, but it won't be flashy. You're going to make sure that your English is perfect. And when I say English, I mean standard English, that it is perfectly clipped. And that's something, I've never been wealthy, but that was something for me. That's how that exaggerated visibility operates for me, where, and I, when I go into a white space, I make sure, and I say this in my trainings, and it's kind of a joke, that I conjugate the verb to be correctly. Like, that's a big thing when I'm really into my IRO and I'm really trying to demonstrate and make sure that these people see me, is that my English is going to be impeccable. I'm going to use words. And I've even kind of gotten into doing it in such a way. It's like, I'm not going to use big words. I'm going to use small words that are impactful. So I'm going to use the word pithy, you know, to make a point, you know? And so, but a lot of it, when I was doing it, I was doing it so that I wanted the people that were in the room who were white to make sure that they could see me, that they knew that I was either a force to be reckoned with or that I was smart enough. And that's the harm. Toni Morrison talks about, like, you know, racism is a distraction. And she unpacks that by saying it's a distraction because we'll spend 20 years, someone will say, I don't like your hair. We'll spend 20 years showing that biologically our hair is okay. Someone will say that I don't like, you know, this or that. And we'll spend year after year trying to prove that that is not the case, instead of, why don't I just live out of my authentic self? And I'm going to be who I am, and you're going to like me or you're not going to like me. And so, so that's one example in terms of class within that one race. And I'll pause there in case you have a follow-up question.
Yeah, I got a follow-up question to that. So given you're kind of talking about exaggerated presence, mm-hmm. or kind of the caricature that people give in order to be seen, maybe say a little bit about the social pressure.
Yeah.
That kind of pushes people, because you're not doing that in a vacuum, right?
Right.
You know, if grandma and her friends and other people are leaning into that, mm-hmm. we don't like standing outside of that, because that means to stand outside of your social identity. So say a little bit about how social pressure within a group happens, but also in terms of the work and what you're doing, which you bring history and travel to kind of break apart or to expand how history changes people.
Yes, the social pressure is fierce. I mean, in one regard, you understand that. So taking my example of being in, so I'm also a retired or recovering lawyer. And so I did litigation. And so I had to make sure that my arguments were perfect and all those things, because the social pressure is that white folks oftentimes do not think that a Black lawyer or Black professional is capable of doing the job in the same manner or better than the majority white group. And so the social pressure in that instance is that I'm afraid that I might be fired, I might be demoted, I might be cast out, or they may just destroy my influence within that space where they will just silence my voice. So that's kind of in that setting. In another setting where you're talking about grandma and mom and dad and your relatives, I vividly remember when I was probably 10. And so my side of the family, my grandfather and my mother's side in particular, was an Air Force officer. He spoke seven languages, and he prided himself, and he was my biggest influence. And so there was a pressure, one, of making sure I pleased him, but also there were other family members who didn't take on kind of that aura of respectability. And I remember going to Baltimore and visiting my cousins, and my cousin saying to my brother and myself, "You sound white." You know, you sound white. And so there's a pressure to, if I want to be in that group, I need to change my language. I need to change how I say things. I need to change how I operate in that particular setting. And so these social pressures, they're constantly going on. And I want to make one particular point that oftentimes internalized racial oppression and inferiority is done for survival. So I don't mm-hmm. want to make this a negative thing. Mm-hmm. We're surviving, and to the racism that's outward, that's being done to us. And there's always that fear of physical violence, of physical damage and physical harm. And so in order to avoid that, I will do things to make sure that I'm not harmed physically, intellectually, emotionally. And so it's a survival mechanism as well. And so that's why I said it's not terrible, because it's a survival mechanism, but it also moves us away from who we're supposed to be authentically.
And John, as you were describing that, I was thinking, it's like, that sounds, in the intercultural development continuum, it sounds a lot like minimization, or at least how I provide feedback when people of color find themselves at minimization, that sometimes it's a coping strategy. Yes. How do I not bring more attention to myself? So if I can be just a little less ethnic, whatever that means, or a little less female, or a little yes. less poor, or a little less whatever that thing is. And there's something liberating that happens when you get to the point where you can say, I'm comfortable in my skin, and I'm going to do that. Because I was thinking of someone, there was this big dinner that happened yesterday, and the invitation said, you know, wear business attire. And I was talking with someone and I said, you know, is this, she was also identifying as Black. I said, is this our attire or is this
that's right.
their attire?
That's right. Right.
Their attire, because no, I know what the language was. The language was your Sunday clothes, right? That's what the language was, right? So this is your Sunday clothes. And that was the question. I said, do you think this is our Sunday clothes? Because, you know, my Sunday clothes, I've been out of it a little bit, but I still got the clothes. I can show up. Get that. Or is it their Sunday clothes? Because their Sunday clothes, you know, is a pair of slacks and a button-down shirt, maybe a t-shirt, right? But then also, I ended up doing my Sunday clothes to feel comfortable. But I was also intentional, because I knew this was going to be, for a white organization, a lot of white people there. So I intentionally wore Afrocentric clothing. Right. So, and maybe just daring someone to say, is that Sunday wear? Is
right.
that business wear? Because I will say, yes, it is. Thank you very much. So I just wanted to make that comment that it sounded a whole lot like that intercultural development inventory, that minimization stage, and also to comment how it's, there's something liberating when you figure out what's going on and you can find that confidence, courage, I don't give a care, whatever it is, attitude, that I'm just going to show up as myself. But when we do that, I think there's often this little voice that says, but what's going to be the cost?
Yeah.
The cost either not being taken seriously, the cost of having to answer endless conversations, or how do I handle a sideways remark? There's always that little thing. So when I do that, my tanks have to be really full on all the levels. So to prepare for whatever might happen afterwards.
Tag on to that intercultural lens of things. So working in the Intercultural Student Development Center at Calvin, we use words like the extra tax that you have to pay.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like when you're code switching all the time. And I'm thinking about that. I have been like really wrestling with my own racial trauma after a long period of all of that code switch. And I'm a cross-cultural person. So part of that code switching I love to do, but part of it is just not the part where you're like, I can work in this culture and this culture and this culture, but more like I need to minimize myself, or I have to take on more of these Eurocentric attitudes to be able to be respected and fit in. That causes a lot of like exhaustion, one, and then trauma too. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then I have a follow-up question after that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's there's so definitely good. That. Oh, yeah, that's so, so good. And I really appreciate it. There's definitely the trauma that goes into all of this. Just taking Michelle's example of what she wore to this event, and having to be, you know, prepared when you go into these spaces, that's another manifestation called hypervigilance, that we constantly have to be hypervigilant. And when someone says something, we'll be thinking about it hours after the event is over. Did they mean this or did they mean that? What were they really saying? And so that increases that level of trauma. It's funny, just yesterday I was being interviewed for this organization, and they were giving one example of one. I was a part of a cohort on racial justice, and they were talking about one of our cohort members and how he worked in these foreign countries. And I asked the person who was interviewing me, well, where are you from? And he says, I'm from Colorado. And he made this comment, and he was joking. He was saying, yeah, you know, I'm not from like Mali. I'm not from the jungles of this, the jungles of that. And I immediately just jumped in and said, and you're not from the middle of Texas, right? And so having, you know, kind of like, don't describe these other places as being extreme without labeling places within our own country that are very extreme and very dangerous.
So my follow-up question is, part of the work that we do is we provide student support and affinity grouping for students to have spaces like how we say, let down your hair, take a breath, or like the language that we use. But we actually get some resistance from students and sometimes parents really about, and not majority parents of color, that for whatever reason, whether they want their student to succeed or what, but we get this pushback of why are you grouping them this way and what are you doing? And do you have any ways for us to be able to communicate well how that affinity grouping is sometimes a good support rather than a way to separate people?
Yeah, there's two things that I thought of when you were asking that question. One is, if we look at the definition again of IRO, it's that multi-generational, right? And so it's generation to generation. And if we couple that with racism is a shapeshifter, meaning how it manifested when they were younger is different than how it manifests now. And the strategies needed then are different than the strategies that are needed now. And so in that instance, I think there's a necessity to affirm that older generation and to really explain like these affinity groups are necessary because we have affinity groups in every other area except for race. We have affinity groups. If we're talking about church, we have a men's group, we have a women's group, we have children's, and it even goes down. We have singles, we have single women, you know, all these affinity groups that we don't call affinity groups and we're not offended by them. It's only when we talk about race that within the church and outside of the church that we get so nervous about affinity groups. Mm. Sorry, you kind of got me fired up on that.
No, don't apologize, because we needed to, you know, I think that's something that we all need to hear, our listeners need to hear. Yeah, so thank you.
So John, I 100% affirm that. So I'm going to ask you the other question that Jane and I sometimes get. Okay, you have all these groups for this group and this group. How come there's not a white group?
Yeah.
And so then I'll tell you what my answer is. Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to hear yours. So that's really funny because I think that's more of a whataboutism than an actual reality. Right. Because I know in my own work and experience, whenever I try to create affinity groups, I inevitably get a deluge of emails saying, I am so offended. Isn't it? Aren't we supposed to be together? Aren't we supposed to do these things? So I know that's coming. So I kind of call them on it. It's like, we do need these affinity groups, and you actually have affinity groups, and you have really negative ones, white supremacists, Proud Boys, and you have some that can be, that's less seen as threatening, but country clubs that only allow white people to be in there, or they can't say that they only allow white people to be in there. And so you have to have someone, the only way that you can become a member of that country club is someone who's already a member allows you to come in. And that's what law professor Daria Reuthmeyer from USC calls reproducing racism. So we could stop the way that racism is being done today, but because it's been in play for so long, it will automatically reproduce itself unless we intentionally and consistently fight against it. It will automatically reproduce itself.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, thank you. Yeah. So my answer is like, well, the white nationalism group would scare me, but you could start a white ally group. That would be amazing.
That's a good one.
That would be amazing if you did a white ally group. Yeah. Then it's usually crickets.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Amen to that.
In the previous place I worked, we did create white affinity groups, and we did get pushback from everyone. Like, oh my goodness, what are you doing? It's like, well, they want to do some work. They want to have some conversations, and we need to provide that space for them to work, you know, figure out what is this racism stuff, and how have I reproduced it? So, yeah.
So necessary. And that's the only way that we can, from my perspective, the only way that we can really have true solidarity cross-racially is if that there are these affinity groups where white folks are earnestly and honestly interrogating how they've been socialized to be white as it's defined out there. And so, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with you, Susie, that these affinity groups are absolutely necessary.
Yeah. And a lot of good can come from it when you have, when there is accountability, right?
Yes.
Because it's not just go make a white group. It's when there is accountability and there's check-ins.
John, I want to come back to the question of how does history help reduce how does it help reduce?
Yeah, that's a great question. It helps reduce it by, I think, allowing everyone who's going through this immersive learning experience or who are really looking at factual and nuanced history to understand just how violent and pervasive racism was and racism is, and how it can continue to be unless we fight against it. And so understanding that historical component of violence, but also it has to be modulated or coupled with understanding the history of resistance within these different people groups. We cannot just talk about mm-hmm. racial history mm-hmm. only in the violence, because if we do that, it will make Black folks and other people of color incredibly frustrated, and it will place white folks to only be ridden with guilt and shame. And so they're unable to move. But if we balance and talk about both the violence and the resistance, it gives us a way forward, because that when you talk about resistance, no matter how painful that resistance is, it gives us a way to reimagine what we could create as a country and as a community.
How do you personally work on IRO stuff?
Oh no, that's a great question. Okay. That's what needs to happen. I need to work on it daily or as consistently as possible. I believe that when I talked about dying daily, and when I talked about not being conformed to this world and being transformed, with every other sin we teach and we preach, that's a part of discipleship. But we have to talk about it in this vein also, that me working on my internalized racism is a spiritual discipline that is necessary. Yep. And if I don't keep working on it and don't keep dying to it, then it will manifest either very similarly, or new ways will crop up and manifest. And so I have to have this deep interrogation of an introspection of what's going on in these different moments. And so there are moments when I will just sit and take, when we talk about quiet time, and the way that we think about it typically in evangelical circles is you have your Bible open, you have your journal, and you're praying and you're writing things down. We have to have that same kind of discipline where we set aside time to think through. I had an interaction with a white coworker today, and this is what happened, and think through, this is what I felt, and then start asking questions. Why did I feel that way? Or why did I say the thing that I said? Was I trying to comfort them in that moment because we were in the middle of a group conflict? Was I trying to distance myself from other people of color in that space? And so there has to be this deep introspection and interrogation that happens. The philosopher George Yancey, who wrote, I think he wrote White Rage, he talks about this Greek word called parrhesia, which is it's this deep meaning, and it's in scripture as well. But he talks about parrhesia, where it's like this deep self-reflection and deep listening, but also we have to be in this frank, truthful way that we speak, that we have to be fierce in our truth telling, and we have to be fierce in our listening of the truth as well, and allow that truth to metabolize inside of our bodies, inside of our minds, and how we operate and how we function. And so we can't become demoralized in this introspection. It really is a way to lead us to freedom and to lead us to liberation.
We need like 3, 4, 5 more episodes of this. Seriously.
Susie, that is a wonderful segue, is that we're going to have one more, at least one more session with John. So why don't we wrap this one up? This has been a lot of rich information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I appreciate you tying IRO to coping strategies and highlighting that IRO can look different from racial group, ethnic group, generationally, perhaps even gender, it can look like. So we could be talking about the same term or concept, internalized racial oppression, but what it looks like and how people cope with it, deal with it, accept it, reject it. There's a number of factors that come into play, which is food for thought, and definitely more conversation. So to all our listeners, if this has been fascinating to you, I would encourage you, first of all, to listen to this episode again, and listen to this episode again and see if what stirs up within you about, hey, might this be something that's a part of my life and might it be showing up? And if I recognize that it's showing up, am I willing to do anything about it or am I going to push it away? And four are the people who represent dominant identities. It's not your job to point out IRO in other people.
Amen.
So it is not your job to come up and say, Michelle, I think you are experiencing IRO because you might
I have
see
your
something
back.
Else. You might see something else come up. I'm going to call my crew because I know Susie and Jane Bridge are ready for a fight. And who knows, John might fly in with that.
That's right.
It's like, oh, I'm going to show you IRO.
IRO.
But John, thank you so much for sitting with us and being a part of this conversation. I can't wait until we are able to talk again. For our listeners, again, one more homework assignment. I want to encourage you to like and share and subscribe if you haven't already subscribed to this. Share this episode with other people. We just found out that there are many more of you listening than we thought were listening, which is absolutely exciting and a little terrifying. But thank you so much. We really appreciate you going on this journey with us. Until next time, we want to encourage you to keep the faith and keep fighting for justice. This has been the Antioch Podcast.
You've been listening to the Antioch Podcast. Conversations about biblical anti-racism. You can help us by spreading the word about the Antioch Podcast by sharing this episode on your favorite social media platform and by leaving us a review on our Facebook page or Apple Podcasts. Your shares and reviews really help us reach more people with the message of biblical anti-racism. Thanks.